Good evening, everyone. My name is Matt Nowski. I am wearing several hats this evening. I'm Associate Professor of Music here at Clark. I'm one of the co-directors of the Extensible Toy Piano Project Festival, along with David Clayman. I am the director of the Communication and Culture Program at Clark, which is sponsoring this keynote address. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Kyle Gann. Kyle Gann is a composer of renown. He earned his doctorate from Northwestern University. He's been an associate professor at Bard since 1997. He has been commissioned by numerous performing organizations and received grants from many places, including the National Endowment for the Arts. And his music can be heard on the New Tone, Lovely Music, and Monroe Street labels. He is a musicologist with several books to his credit. He is one of the leading authorities on a composer named Conlon Nancarrow. He has a book out on Cambridge University Press called The Music of Conlon Nancarrow. He has a second book out called American Music in the 20th Century, which is unique in its perspective on the American musical scene in the last 100 years. And newly published by University of California Press is his third book, Music Downtown, Articles from the Village Voice, 1986 to 2000. That introduces Mr. Gann in a third capacity. He is very well known as a music critic, largely as this book indicates, for many years with the Village Voice, but he's published more than 2,000 articles with articles in publications as diverse as the American Music Box, American Theosophist, Art Form, As Path in Action, Atlantica, Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune, Dialogue, Fanfare, Musical America, New Art Examiner, New York Times, Opera News, Pulse, and the Chicago Reader. And that's where I first encountered Mr. Gann's writing. I went in 1983 to the University of Chicago as a young graduate student and became immersed in graduate studies. And one day opening the alternative newspaper in Chicago, I started to read reviews of the local music scene and became thoroughly enchanted with his writing. And it reminded me of several important things that have always been important. That at a moment when I was most immersed in thinking about music in an academic setting, his writing reminded me that there's a musical world outside of a school, and that was an important lesson. And more importantly, in the quality of his writing, he made me think, remember that although music is a specific set of practices and there's descriptive languages about what's going on, that ultimately music is the exchange of ideas between people, and it's a communicative form. I think that always comes through very strongly in Mr. Gann's writing and makes him the perfect keynote speaker for our festival. Won't you please join me in welcoming Kyle Gann.
Trying to hit a target blindfolded because you don't really know when you come to an event what the perspective of the other people is and what you're going to find there. And so I'm not sure I've done that, but what I thought I should do would be to talk about the toy piano and what it connotes in the various milieus that I live my life with. And another thing about keynote addresses, it seems formal enough to read verbatim, which I don't usually do, but I'll do it tonight. In 1948, John Cage wrote a suite for toy piano. The instrument he used was only 2 octaves wide and only contained white keys, unlike most of the instruments you'll hear here tonight. At that time, he was writing mostly quiet music because, as he later said, I didn't think there was anything good about anything big in society. Cage's willingness to limit himself to white keys was strikingly dissident in a noisy, patriotic decade which produced perhaps more symphonies than any other decade before or since. In a survey of the symphony I once prepared, I found more symphonies written by well-known composers in 1946, the year after World War II ended, than in any other year since the 18th century. Most of them big, noisy works using the orchestra's full potential for brass and percussion. The same year in which the suite for toy piano was written saw the composition of one of the largest symphonies ever, Olivier Messiaen's Tarantella Symphony, written in 10 movements for an orchestra that included an extended percussion section, solo piano, and an electronic instrument called the On Martinot. Clearly, Cage's dubious view of the big things of society was one that not many people shared yet at the moment. Soon afterward, however, the idea of pitch limitation seemed to be in the air. In 1950, Elliot Carter wrote 8 etudes and a fantasy for woodwinds using extreme pitch limitations in 2 movements, just a D major triad in the 3rd etude and the pitch G in the 7th etude. There were similar European works. There was a set of pieces by Giacinto Chelsi written for 1 pitch, although he kind of cheated and used pitch bends. So he still called it 1 pitch. Those may have been isolated experiments, but in 1960, Lamont Young wrote a piece using only 2 pitches, B and F sharp, which he indicated were to be held for a long time. And this time, the idea kind of took off as a movement. In 1966, Steve Reich wrote a piece called Piano Phase using only 5 pitches. 3 years later, Philip Glass wrote a piece called Music in Fifths using 7 pitches, 5 in each hand with 3 overlaps. In 1975, while still in college, I, like Cage, wrote a piece that only used the white notes of the scale, no sharps or flats. And soon afterward, Jonathan Kramer, a reformed 12-tone composer who would later teach at Columbia University, wrote a series of works all limited in pitch, using only 5 pitches in a piece called Moving Music for 13 clarinets, 6 pitches in Music for Piano Number 5, and an uninflected E minor scale for an entire orchestra piece called Moments in and Out of Time. Theodore Adorno once referred to the attitude of Richard Strauss in his tone poems as that of the grand industrialist who knows that his resources are endless. The 1960s, though, gave birth to a musical environmentalism that rejected the industrialist attitude in favor of a more cautious husbanding of resources. This environmentalism continues to have an adherence. Carl Stone made his 15-minute electronic piece, Shing Key, from merely a few seconds of a sampled Schubert recording. The composer John Luther Adams has written many pieces using a C major scale, up to a 75-minute orchestra work called In the White Silence in 1998. And one of the most electric performances I've ever seen was a piece from 1988 simply called Click by the Minnesota composer Mary Ellen Childs, which was written for 3 people simply holding 2 wood blocks each, which they would hit against each other in really intricate patterns with the inventive logic and lightning speed of a Warner Brothers cartoon. From one point, this interesting self-limitation seemed like a historical anomaly. Before 1948, the history of musical resources looks more or less like an uninterrupted crescendo. From the diatonic scale to the chromatic scale to the quarter tone scale to the 43-tone scale of Perry Karch, from simple consonances to seventh and ninth chords, unresolved dissonances to thick tone clusters to noises, and from the unaccompanied choir to the classical orchestra to the romantic orchestra with a large brass section to the modern orchestra with its array of percussion and to the expansion of these means via recorded sounds. Nevertheless, the most emblematic gesture, possibly the most widely imitated gesture of the late 20th century, maybe Morton Feldman's decision to base virtually his entire prolific career, with including many works that lasted several hours, on a single dynamic level, as soft as possible. After Cage and Feldman seemed to give permission, hundreds of young composers wrote pieces that only used one dynamic level, or one scale, or multiples of one instrument, or some other limitation that would have seemed extreme before that. Why did self-limitation suddenly seem like such an attractive idea? Perhaps it's partly because of what Stravinsky described as the terror of too many possibilities. As long as all possibilities were open to him, Stravinsky said, composing was impossible. And he added, "My freedom will be so much greater and more meaningful the more narrowly I limit my field of action and the more I surround myself with obstacles. Whatever diminishes constraints diminishes strength. The more constraints one imposes, the more one frees oneself of the chains that shackle the spirit." And I like to link this quotation with one from Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, which is, "One should recall the compulsion under which every language so far has achieved strength and freedom, the metrical compulsion of rhyme and rhythm." Perhaps it was the freedom opened up by the emancipation of dissonance and atonality that required Cage and others after him to create their own limitations. Richard Strauss, after all, was at least limited to a romantic harmonic language that reined in his profusion of orchestral techniques. In 1921, Schoenberg brought his own experiment with total freedom to an end with the invention of the 12-tone row. The popular stereotype of the artist is that he or she creates an image from his or her unfettered imagination. But most artists, I think, realize that one's imaginative vision does not go onto the page or into the sound file intact and in the same form in which it first came to their head. Art is a dialogue with the material, a wrestling with material and reality and perceptual constraints, and often a kind of problem solving. None of these can operate if you get the friction to create sparks of insight if the possibilities are truly endless. As my colleague Joan Tower is always saying, when you're composing, you think you're in control, but you're not. Another spur to limitation may have also come from the explosion of the number of artists. In the 1980s, in an event not too dissimilar from this one, I heard a statistic that there were 40,000 people in America who called themselves composers. With numbers like that, self-limitation can become self-identity. If two composers use all the resources available, it might become difficult to distinguish them. But if you're the only composer to write symphonies for electric guitars, or the only composer to write for player piano, or the only one to write five-hour works in monochromatic pianissimo, you might distinguish yourself from the other 40,000. This kind of finding one's own limited niche has been especially common in New York City, where hundreds of composers are cooped up in a small area. Of course, during the same period I'm talking about, from 1948 through the 50s and 60s and 70s, the buzz in the profession was about how limitations were vanishing. The new resources of electronics were promising a musical world free from limitations, a world in which any possible sound would become available for musical use. Besides the suite for toy piano and Taranga Leela, 1948 was also the year of Pierre Schaeffer's first tape composition, Etude au chemin de fer. Magnetic recording tape had become commercially available only the year before. Etude au chemin de fer was made from the sounds of locomotives. Later, Anaïa Lockwood would use a purring cat in her tape piece, Tiger Balm, field recordings of the Hudson River in her sound map of the Hudson River, and recordings of tree frogs, volcanic eruptions, and even earthquakes in her 1975 piece, World Rhythms. On a more quotidian level, Charles Amirkhanian used fart sounds, flushing toilets, and the roar of the crowd at a soccer game, and his homage to Samuel Beckett, pas de bois. If I were to hazard a guess at a sound that has never yet been used in a piece of music, someone in this audience would immediately contradict me and give examples. Every sound imaginable, from the subsonic mating calls of tree beetles, which David Dunn has used for music, to the sound waves of the planets in motion, has been used by someone somewhere. In addition to the newfound availability of all sounds for musical use, technology has made it possible to pursue infinity in terms of what we can do with those sounds. Technology has made it available the lightning speed of Conlon Nancarrow's player piano music, which in his study number 25 achieves a rate of 175 notes per second. And also any tempo relationship imaginable, not only close tempo relationships like 60 against 61, but irrational ratios like 2 against the square root of 2, and even transcendental ratios like e against pi, being the base of natural logarithms. Pauline Oliveris performs with software that can alter the apparent acoustics of her music to mimic those of another space, so that she can perform in a storefront and give the illusion of performing in a cathedral, and then transforming that ambience into the sound of a living room. Henry Gwozda uses software that was originally created for airline pilots so that they could take in a lot of different messages at the same time in order to create the illusion of three-dimensional space with only two speakers, so that in Gwozda's music you can hear a basketball bouncing toward you, or seagulls flying overhead, or in one case even a flute tone going through your head. Seattle's inventor-composer Trimpin, who's the recipient of a well-deserved MacArthur Award, has made rhythmic fugues from the computer-timed drips of water in the fountains, microtonal bass clarinets with hundreds of keys spiraling down the instrument and fingered by computers so that all a human performer has to do is blow into the mouthpiece, a computerized prepared piano in which the preparation can be automatically added and removed during performance, computerized mallets that can achieve a continuous drone from the membranes of timpani by rubbing them with superhuman endurance, machines that will play every instrument of the orchestra via MIDI, an assemblage of toy pianos synchronized by a computer and played in three-dimensional space via MIDI. And in fact, one thing that he hasn't invented yet, but he drew for me on a napkin in a restaurant once, he designed for me something I wanted, which is a grand piano that could be automatically retuned by a computer during performance. And he had the mechanism all worked out to do it. The only problem was it cost about $200,000 or $300,000. More and more composers, especially those who write film soundtracks, are realizing orchestra pieces on their computers with a fidelity that can no longer be distinguished in some cases from a traditional orchestra. We live in a time in which the practical limitations on sound production seem to be evaporating like the morning dew. In these same decades, however, as we were being given all these new possibilities, much was also being taken away. As our ability to create a realistic simulacrum of an orchestra in our computer software increases, our access to actual orchestras decreases at a similar rate. In 100 years, our most common reference point for sonic fidelity has modulated from a symphony orchestra at Carnegie Hall to the vinyl record, to the digital compact disc, to the MP3, and this last also often played through the tiny speakers on the sides of a laptop computer, with a corresponding loss of sound quality inherent in each new medium. In the early decades of the 20th century, it was common for orchestra conductors to include one new American work on each concert. This practice declined drastically after World War II. Today, it is safe to say that the vast majority of American composers have no access to an orchestra on any regular basis. Those who do have such access had better develop a facility for writing 8 to 10 minute concert openers with lots of percussion, which is the typical marginalized placement and character of new American work on most orchestra programs today. Access to record promotion and distribution has become far more limited as well. In 1970, Cage's Suite for Toy Piano made its recording debut on the Columbia label. Today, of course, very little new and experimental music appears on the labels owned by the four multinational conglomerates, Sony, BMG, Universal Music Group, EMI, and Warner. together control 70% of the world market and 85% of the U.S. market. And when I say mention 85% of the U.S. market, I'm sure that the entire audience realize that the remaining 15% consists mostly of independent rock labels. When I was a teenager, wanting to keep up with the latest new music on major labels like Columbia, Deutsche Grammophon, and none such, by the time I started the Village Voice in 1986, new music was on small specialty labels like New Albion and Mode. By the 1990s, the best new music was on artist-owned labels that often had very little distribution. And today, I get most of my new music on CDRs, except when I download it off a composer's website. Not only has Ani DiFranco gone independent with her own label, a composer as famous in my youth as Peter Maxwell Davies now offers his recordings via download through his website. Access to commercial radio has declined so far that statistics are hardly necessary to cite. When I was in high school, I learned what was going on in contemporary music by means of list recording off of the radio station WRRFM in Dallas, radio station that was then and is still owned by the city of Dallas, in fact. In the early 1970s, I became familiar in this way with music by Milton Babbitt, Charles Warren, Leon Kircher, and Terry Riley, and in fact, with Cage's keyboard music, and this is where I first heard this week for Talking Out. It was on WRR. It's unimaginable today that any young musician could learn what's going on in music outside of pop by listening to the radio. During my lifetime, there has grown a palpable feeling of the music I'm involved with becoming more and more marginalized and cut off from society. Many composers, especially those of us in academia, have colluded with this marginalization to some extent or another, out of a sense of modesty, out of a feeling that security is easier to achieve in a closed society of like-minded individuals than in a wider social sphere in which the value of one's work is more subject to challenge, or more recently, out of a self-deprecation that considered pop music somehow more authentic and then thus more valuable than our own music, with an introvert's typical compensatory tendency to overvalue socially constructed reality. Every day, more composers join the do-it-yourself bandwagon. Self-publishing, self-recording, self-promoting. With that comes tremendous freedom in terms of content, but also a whole new set of limitations in terms of access. For instance, I always wanted to be a classical DJ, and now I run my own internet radio station, Post Classic Radio on live365.com, with a line of new music that fulfills my wildest fantasy of what a radio station can be. I play a lot of music from CDRs that isn't commercially available, music from old cassette tapes that have never come out on any commercial release. Of course, no more than 100 people can listen at a time, but this has proved not to be too onerous a burden because my average number of listeners at any given time is 2. And I pay $30 a month for the privilege of running this radio station. I'm playing MP3s, and I assume that most of my audience listens through their computers. In terms of content, I've achieved my wildest dreams, but in terms of access to the public, I hardly exist at all. We've been given limitless software, hardware, speed, manipulative capabilities, and sonic sophistication. What's been taken away from us falls under the category access to the public. Yet some have argued that access to the public is the most important resource composers have. In his argumentative little 1974 book, Stockhausen Serves Imperialism, Cornelius Cardew wrote, "A composition is not an end product, not in itself a useful commodity. The end product of an artist's work, the useful commodity in the production of which he plays a role, is ideological influence. The production of ideological influence is highly socialized, involving, in the case of music, performers, critics, impresarios, agents, managers, etc., and above all, and this is the artist's real means of production, an audience. Under the bourgeois dictatorship, it is clearly impossible to bring work with a decidedly socialist or revolutionary content to bear on a mass audience. Access to this audience, the artist's real means of production, is controlled by the state." And let me repeat that. Access to the audience is the artist's real means of production, not sounds, not recordings, not technology, but access to the audience. There's something heartbreakingly poignant about the fact that just as our resources for sound production and manipulation are asymptotically approaching infinity, our even more important access to a mass audience is asymptotically approaching zero. There is a great reluctance in the Western world to refer to control of musical distribution by private corporations as censorship, since censorship is something that can traditionally be done only by governments, not by privately owned entities. However, it is becoming increasingly clear that the corporate world and government have in fact merged. In actuality, have not yet completely in appearance. And that the elected government is so completely beholden to the corporate world that the corporations are pulling the strings. One of the best known examples is the corporation Clear Channel, which is the world's largest broadcaster, concert promoter, and billboard advertising firm, and whose vice chair of communications, Tom Hicks, is a member of the Bush Pioneer Club for Elite and Generous Donors, and who made Bush a multimillionaire in 1998 by purchasing the Texas Rangers. When the CEO for Halliburton becomes vice president of the country and hands out no-bid contracts to Halliburton, distinctions between corporations and the government become academic. And thus there is no longer any difference between Sony BMG telling a musician, this doesn't suit our needs, and this is against the interests of the state. The interest of the state in this case is to make money, and music not made for the purpose of maximizing profit will remain undistributed, which for all intents and purposes is the American word for censored. As Martin Scherzinger and Arvid Ashby had written, and this is kind of a long quote, but I can't better it myself. The culture industry thus aims to optimize an ever-increasing cycle of commodity production and destruction. While changes in fashion are often grounded in genuine socio-cultural needs, most of the music produced in the ensuing style cannot answer to these needs. Necessarily, such music is drained of musical or social values that may transcend the contingencies of that style. So, musical expressions that encourage the discipline of imaginative concentration, for example, will not be marketed or promoted. The more deeply satisfying and rewarding to listeners such music turns out to be, the less it is in the interest of the commercial industry to produce and promote it. With its exclusive focus on maximizing turnover through rapid-fire stylistic shifting, the industry favors music that will perish just as soon as it has been purchased. This is the mechanism that Slavoj Zizek calls the capitalist logic of waste and planned obsolescence, unquote. Everyone who teaches knows this phenomenon. The shelf life of a popular band is about 3 years, and once the record companies have milked as much money as they can from a band, they drop it for the next one. My students used to think I was really hip because I talked about 9 Inch Nails in class, and then the fourth year when I brought them up, they suddenly said, who's that? Planned obsolescence is a necessary component of commercial success. We all know the stories about software developers who perfect their product after a few years, but who have to keep changing it even after it's perfected so the company will be able to continually make more income off upgrades. I remember Laurie Spiegel, who invented Music Mouse, went through a terrible problem because she got the program to its maximum capacity, and then she had to keep adding bells and whistles to it, or the distributor would quit, would just drop it from their catalog if she didn't create upgrades that people would have to buy every year. Even textbooks must be revised every 4 years, whether they need it or not, because revisions are where publishers get their next influx of money. Meanwhile, as the wheels of revision and new products spin faster and faster, our intellectual culture has reached a stagnation that would have seemed unimaginable when I was young. In 1973, when Stockhausen or Steve Reich were writing new piece, the recording would come out on Rush Gramophone within a few months, and everyone would know the piece the following year. Now my more adventurous students, the ones who are really on the lookout for wild new music, are beginning to discover Glenn Branca's symphonies from the early 80s. The lag time for a composition to reach a widespread audience used to be measured in months. Now I estimated it's something over 20 years. In fact, I have to come to a conference like this to remind myself that culture is advancing at all, because in the other worlds I inhabit, music criticism, the world my undergraduate students know, the world of classical music performance that I'm very close to, you get the feeling that the culture has fallen into the state of the main character of the movie Memento, unable to create any new memories. This too is partly determined by the corporate nature of publishing. When you take a book proposal to a publisher, the first thing they do is look at the financial figures for other books on the same subject that have been published by other publishers. Now, what if there are no other books on that subject? Then obviously there's no interest in that subject, and they're not going to make any money off of it, so they won't publish one. That's, what this means is, if people don't already know something, you can't tell them about it. For years, in the 1980s, long after Philip Glass and Steve Reich had become very well-known composers, publishers would not touch about a book about minimalism because there were no books on minimalism. And somehow, Brock Swartz managed to get a book on minimalism published by Small Faden Press, and all of a sudden, the next year, there were four books on minimalism. And so now, for years, I've been pushing a book on post-minimalism, and nobody's interested because there are no books on that, therefore, no one's interested. And the year that there were four biographies of Charles Ives out, Oxford asked me to write a biography of Charles Ives. Cage wrote for Troy County because there was nothing good about anything big in society, but it seems that there was a lot more good in the big things in society back then than there was today. At least in 1970, the suite for Troy County was able to be recorded on America's most prominent record label, and to get played on the radio where a 15-year-old composer in Dallas would get excited about it. Cage made his own limitations, but he didn't face anything as restrictive as the corporate censorship disguised as social apathy that we're facing today. Some 15 years ago, the Indonesian composer Iwayan Sadra came to this country and talked about censorship in his homeland, which was severe. At one theater performance for which he supplied the music, the army surrounded the hall with tanks and was prepared to arrest the entire troop if any criticism of the government was heard. Indonesian artist, Sadra said, put a lot of creativity into criticizing the government so subtly and indirectly that the audiences will understand what's going on, but that the military won't catch on. And in this case, the tanks left without any incident. Sadra suggested that if we are faced with censorship here, and this was during the time of the Two Live Crew controversy when artists were being asked to sign anti-obscenity clause when they received grants, that we should be very clever in getting our message out past the government in subversive ways. As artists, he said, we have to know what to do not to be caught by the censors. This takes far more creativity than just thinking about what we would do if we were free. This kind of statement seems to suggest that the limitations of our current marginalization as composers can be as much of a spur to our creativity as Cage's use of the toy piano was. We all debate how this can happen. The government censors in our case are trying to prevent the spread of any content that does not promise to make money for corporations and also promise to be ephemeral, to disappear quickly so that more money can be made very soon. This goes so much against the grain of what most of us want in a healthy artistic life that it's difficult to imagine how to package our music to create that illusion. On the contrary, we're all trying to create a rich, enduring music that will grow more meaningful with time and improve on subsequent listening. We want to have our careers as composers nurtured for decades beyond the three-year expiration date of record company interest. In any case, I'd like to encourage recognition that the marginalization composers suffer today is not deserved, that much has been taken away from us that we have a right to expect, and that we all have as much right to a healthy musical society as we do to clean air and water and freedom of speech and political discourse, no matter whether somebody's making money off of it or not. Personally, I feel composers should insist that we have a right to have our music published and distributed, as composers have had for centuries. And even more importantly, that the public has a right to hear what is really going on in the artistic life of the world and not have their choices calculatedly restricted to whatever recyclable capital makes the most money for corporations. In return, I believe we need to recognize that what's true of our more theoretical musical materials is also true of our real material, our access to the audience. That it's a dialogue, a process of compromise, a wrestling with perceptions, and a kind of problem solving. We need feedback from the scale we're using, the instrument, the software, and we also need feedback from the mass audience. We can't afford the fiction that we're in complete control. In the early 1990s, I was on a lot of grants panels, and all of them seemed to be going in the direction of getting composers involved with communities, rather than just the mission awards and performance. I don't know whether this grant has continued or whether the money is still there, but I always supported it. After all, when I mentioned to people that I was speaking at a Plug Piano conference this weekend, the reactions were invariably of astonished delight. People were happy to find out that Mozart will write for Plug Piano today, which of course no one knows, even though it's been going on for more than half a century. My optometrist was fascinated. Most people have some experience with Plug Piano, usually from their childhood. This is not something distant or esoteric. In the 1970s, we composers were futzing around with combinatorial hexachords and other arcana, and our alienation from the larger culture seemed like a natural concomitant, if not indeed a just punishment for our picayune technical preoccupations. Such is no longer the case today. We have achieved emancipation of every possible element of music. Now we need to emancipate ourselves from the little corner in which the corporate world has painted us into, happy to siphon away our money in return for continually updated audio software, and many of you know what I mean by that, but refusing to touch our music. After a century of expanding possibilities, we find ourselves in a world of limitations, some of them self-imposed, others imposed against our will. We have more reason than ever to use the toy piano. We use it because we can. It is no longer prohibited, and thanks to Cage, there is precedence for taking it seriously. We use the toy piano because we can afford to. We can control it. It's portable, we can carry it. No one can deny us the use of it. The toy piano has no board of directors on the lookout against cost overruns. We use the toy piano as a symbol of that which lies outside corporate control. We can even connect it to computers and make it do things no toy piano was ever supposed to do. What we can't seem to do with it, though, is communicate to the outside world, the world outside our composing circles, that there's been a repertoire of toy piano music now for 57 years. We're in a very funny position today, saturated with a meaningless kind of freedom. Nothing is prohibited, yet not everything is allowed, because not everything is available. Nothing is allowed to grow because everything is abandoned at birth. Nothing is nurtured. But we are in a better position to rise to the occasion than we were 20 or 30 years ago. And perhaps the restrictions we live under will force us into the most extreme burst of creativity that any musical generation has ever been called upon to achieve. Thank you.
While you're waiting, you might want to visit the installation.